Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we thought we would treat you to the beginning of an early 1980s film trailer.
Yeah, before we go any further, take a load of this.
For 10 centuries, it has waited to be awakened, to be worshipped again like a god, to fill the skies, to cast its shadow over the earth, to release its fury.
Okay, so it's October. You know we're doing stuff related to monsters, horror movies. What on earth was that, Robert?
That was a was part of the trailer to Cue the Winged Serpent, released in 1982, written and directed by B-movie legend Larry Cohen.
Oh, the guy who made God Told Me To.
Yeah, also known for It's Alive and The Stuff. This particular film, though, is, in my opinion, a real gem. Because it's 1982 New York, so it's essentially like late 70s New York.
Yeah, it really gets that griminess and that doominess. I've been trying to figure out exactly what it is about like late 70s New York in movies where it just there's this grim, fatalistic, doomy kind of cynicism that everybody's got where it's like they know the end of the world is coming soon.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is, you could do a whole episode, a whole podcast series just on that vibe. I mean, really, the HBO series The Deuce is kind of attempting to do the same thing, mm-hmm. looking at particular areas of the culture during that time. But yeah, I think there's a certain national cynicism, and then there are obviously some major issues going on in New York City at the time. This trailer adds a little extra issue to that heap. That being a giant flying serpentine creature that may or may not be an Aztec god that is roosting somewhere in the city and occasionally soaring down to grab sunbathers off the roofs of New York City skyscrapers.
And window washers.
Window washers, yeah.
Cops. Anybody who happens to be up there within reach. Now, essentially, this creature is a dragon, right? It is a giant angry looking bird lizard thing. I don't think it has feathers, does it?
No, it's very
smooth.
Very reptilian. It looks kind of like a winged sauropod with enormous eyes. It's a very strange design, but it's stop motion. So mm-hmm. every moment you spend with it in the film is magic.
So this movie is, you know, it's got that grimy, nasty, sleazy B-movie quality, that late 70s Larry Cohen kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it's also kind of good. It's like it's got a funny script. There's like a great scene where the cops are about to storm the nest of the dragon creature and one of them's just drinking a Budweiser.
Yeah, it has an ingenious plot because, I don't know, maybe not ingenious, but it has a clever plot that I really like for a monster movie, which just to run through the cast real quick, you got Candy Clark, you have David Carradine, you have Richard Roundtree.
David Carradine, beta carotene. Why is it every time I say David Carradine, I want to say beta carotene?
I don't know. He's just rich in it, I guess. But most importantly, you have Michael Moriarty.
Who's just great at playing a down-on-his-luck sleazebag.
And he really brings it in this movie. Reviews from the year it came out pretty much agreed with the sentiment. They were like, I don't know about this monster movie, but that Michael Moriarty is fabulous. And he is fabulous in it. He plays essentially, this New York sleazebag who I think he's involved in a diamond heist, and he flees, mm-hmm. and he ends up stumbling upon the nest of the Q, the winged serpent.
Well, because he just happens to climb to the top of the Chrysler Building. Right. I don't remember why he does that. He's just like, well, I'm up here now.
But he discovers like where the monster that is terrorizing the city is located, where its egg is located. And so what does he do with this heroic information? He blackmails the city.
He's right. Pay me $1 million and give me immunity for all my crimes or I won't tell you where the egg is.
Yes. And there's some other elements to the plot that are really fun as well. There's one scene, and this is in the trailer, where David Carradine's police officer character's detective character says, this thing has been prayed back into existence. And there's this whole plot with like an Aztec cult and ritual murders. It's a fabulously fun film.
Now, with the nod to the cult and with Q standing in for Quetzalcoatl, it's clear that the beast in this film is a monsterified version of the ancient Mesoamerican god Quetzalcoatl. And I think it's worth stopping to appreciate that the original Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, is not a monster, but is a holy, magnificent god of the heavens.
Right. And it's unfair to really associate it with a bunch of blood sacrifice. Though we were discussing this a little offline before we came in here. That's often where a lot of people's imagination goes when they are reminded of the Aztec civilization or other Mesoamerican or South American civilizations.
Yeah, this is one thing that I think is kind of sad and unfair, that ancient Mesoamerican religions often get associated with human sacrifice. And it's not unfair because there was no human sacrifice. There was. It's pretty clear that that was a feature of some ancient Mesoamerican religion. But what's unfair is that it's like Mesoamerican religion gets singled out for association with human sacrifice when human sacrifice is just everywhere in the ancient world. There's evidence that the ancient Greeks probably did human sacrifice, the ancient Nordic religions, the Celts and the Scandinavians. I mean, everywhere you look, you'll find evidence of human sacrifice somewhere back in time. So it's not like this was unique to the Mesoamerican religions.
So in this episode, we're going to mostly talk about the religious origins of Quetzalcoatl, as well as some of the things that it has inspired and may have inspired it. We're going to talk a little bit about serpents that actually sort of fly through the air. We're also going to talk about a particular prehistoric flying creature that has been named in Quetzalcoatl's honor.
But let's start with the god itself, Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent. Tell me about this god, Robert.
So in reading a bit about the plumed serpent god, a number of things became really clear. One book I picked up was Rudolfo Anaya's fictional Lord of the Dawn, the legend of Quetzalcoatl, which is, I say fictional, basically what he attempted to do in this book is to provide a narrative, an easily read narrative version of Quetzalcoatl's story.
Okay.
I actually saw a really good user review for this where they pointed out, you know, with Greek myths in particular, it's not just archaeological and anthropological information that we're exposed to as a kid. We're exposed to the stories themselves. We get to kind of experience the stories as just pure stories. And this particular reviewer was saying, you know, I had trouble finding that with Mesoamerican religions, and this book provided that. And the book itself is very good. I'll mention a little bit more as we go forward. But there's an introduction in this book from the University of New Mexico's David M. Johnson, and he does a great job of just rolling through like what was Quetzalcoatl, what did it stand for, and what is our, what do we know, what do we not know about it? And he points out that there's a lot that we do not know about the Toltec Empire. This would be one of the empires preceding the Aztec Empire.
Mm-hmm.
He said that we're only talking the Mesoamerican world roughly 700 years ago. So we're not going into the ancient past, really. He says that we know more about Athens of 2,000 years ago or Hebraic traditions from 3,000 years ago. Mesoamerican world, again, 700 years ago, and there's so much we don't know. And he says this is largely because Spanish friars did what they could to destroy the codices of the Aztecs and the Maya. We have to remember that the most obvious thing here is that this was a world that was invaded by Westerners, by the Spanish, by the Portuguese, and that the culture was ravaged for it. On top of this, the hieroglyphic style books of the Aztecs were there to apparently aid in the memorization of oral literature. So imagine perhaps, this is just my read on the scenario, imagine if only the illustrations and the illuminations of Christian stories survived, but the Bible did not. Or we had mostly artwork to go by in order to figure out what the Greek pantheon consisted of, and what the stories were that were associated with those individuals.
Yeah.
I think that's just a rough example to sort of outline the problems of not having complete access to the information.
But so in general, there's been a great loss of Mesoamerican literature that was in many ways caused by colonialism.
Yeah, he pointed out in this that only something like 16 books survive, 3 Mayan, 6 Oaxaca books, and that most of what we know about pre-conquest culture in Mesoamerica comes from archaeological evidence and post-conquest scribes and scholars. But Quetzalcoatl seems to have existed in this pantheon of Mesoamerican culture for a while, as this kind of wind god who creates the earth by lifting up the heavens. And he was probably a very old god emerging from the beliefs of coastal regions associated with shells and wind and sea. The Quetzal part of his name refers to a rare bird with precious green feathers used in ceremonial dresses. And I should point out that you can look up pictures of Quetzals. There are like 5 different species of Quetzals, and their feathers are quite beautiful. They're found in Mexico and the extreme southern United States.
Yeah, I think does the name refer to their long tail feathers? Is that right?
I believe so. Yeah, and these would have been used in various religious attire.
They are beautiful birds.
And now the Coatl aspect of the name, that refers to a snake tied to earth energy, fertility, and the cyclical nature of life. So in this combo, this god, we have a convergence of earthly and spiritual energy. We have a creature of the ground and a creature of the sky, both as one. And he went by other names as well. He was known as Kukulkan in the Yucatan and Gucumatz in Guatemala. And devotion to the feathered serpent spread as far north as New Mexico and south to Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. And of course, outside of this tradition, obviously we have to point to the fact that this is not the only tradition that involves a winged serpent. You encounter feathered serpents in other religions as well, in Europe and Asia. And essentially, as we pointed out with Q from the movie, it's not that different from other ideas of a dragon, a great holy winged creature.
No, I don't want to try to over-smooth or over-conform the differences between different mythical beasts from around the world. But I am always fascinated by the fact that it seems to me, you know, if I'm not over, you know, overgeneralizing, that so many different cultures have something like a dragon. You know, yeah. There's the European dragon, the ancient Near Eastern dragon, the Chinese dragon. And then if we're saying Quetzalcoatl is in many ways kind of like a dragon, is that just us seeing patterns in things that are objectively not all that similar? Or is that really a pattern? And if so, what is it that causes dragon imagery to arise spontaneously in so many different cultures around the world?
Yeah, I mean, you can also tie in just the serpentine aspect of it. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. there are a lot of world serpents in mythologies.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to be said about our encoded response to the sight of a snake. If cats had a god of the sky they worship, perhaps it would be a cucumber?
a cucumber,
wings in the sky. We don't want to overgeneralize things, but I feel like there are certain creatures of the earth that humans have a natural heightened response to, and then add, you know, several thousand years worth of myth building and world building on top of that, and you get some curious forms.
Well, yeah, I wonder if this goes back to something we talked about, like in our the first monster episode, mm-hmm. where we discussed the idea that what types of animal forms would become most embedded and revered in human consciousness, and
yeah.
you would tend to assume it might be something like an apex predator or some animal representing danger, but then also bringing in qualities that we associate with like intelligence and human characteristics.
Yeah.
But also, just a minute ago, I think you mentioned something about the cyclical nature of the world and of time. I figured that had something to do with the ancient Mesoamerican theology we're talking about here, right?
Yeah, the belief system in ancient Mexico is one in which you had various ages that had preceded our own. Each fallen age was ruled over by an appropriate god. So you had ages of water, ages of fire. Each ended by disharmony between the forces that must otherwise exist in balance. And these were not strictly moral dimensions of good versus evil, but forces apparently more akin to Eastern models of yin and yang.
Hmm.
Though there is a timeless struggle at the heart of this, and it is, I think, very easy to categorize the two players in it into sort of a good versus evil interpretation. But then again, that's our Western minds approaching it too.
Right. You might want to put things in the familiar categories and say you've got God and the devil, but it's not quite that case with what, Quetzalcoatl and Tezcatlipoca?
Yes, Tezcatlipoca, whose name apparently means smoking mirror, referring to the obsidian mirrors used in worship.
That's so good.
So he's essentially the god of the black mirror.
Wow.
Interestingly enough, that black mirror came up in an episode that Christian and I did on John Dee. The English really polymath, but also sorcerer.
Mm-hmm.
He had a mirror that originated in South America or Mesoamerica.
What did he use it for?
Well, magic, of course.
Right.
If you're going to have an obsidian mirror of Tezcatlipoca, you better be using it for magic. But anyway, these two beings, they created the world. It's said by tearing apart a primordial earth goddess. The world was created from the parts of her body out of remorse from the two gods for her unfortunate death. And they also created man and woman. There's an interesting little story where Quetzalcoatl himself has to make a regular pilgrimage into the land of the dead, into Mictlan. And there he has to complete a series of trials for its king and queen so that they'll let him bring the old bones of the dead back up to the surface and then use their ground-up substance to create the next generation of humans.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah, and in this we see, you know, models here that are present elsewhere in the world, and we're reminded of you know, the harrowing of hell or descents into the underworld in Greek mythology.
Maybe Isis and Osiris.
Yeah, yeah. This is a story as old as human time. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
on top of this, Quetzalcoatl is also a culture bringer.
Oh, okay.
So he's associated with architecture, art, and the sacred calendar.
Yet another theme we see in religions all throughout the world, this ancient figure, a figure from the gods bringing knowledge or customs or cultural practices to the humans.
Yeah. Now, according to Johnson, Quetzalcoatl was a major object of worship from around 200 to 900 CE in the urban center of Teotihuacan, a city of Mesoamerican pyramids and some 200,000 residents. So the Toltecs would inherit this city and dominate Mexico through the 12th century. And worship of Quetzalcoatl really took off in the 10th century, where we have this case where the myth really melded with history. He became associated with a cultural hero named Tzeacatl-Topiltzin. And so you get this idea that Topiltzin, this historic figure, by some estimates like the oldest historical figure in Mexico, he becomes merged. We end up merging Quetzalcoatl and Topiltzin into a single entity. He becomes the incarnation of the feathered god. And in doing this, Topiltzin becomes a spiritual figure of peace. And in doing so, he alienates the more militaristic segments of society that don't want to give up human sacrifice and war, two things that Topiltzin is opposed to, saying, you know, hey, maybe we don't need to be at constant war with our neighbors. Maybe we don't need to sacrifice human beings. Maybe we can just sacrifice, I think it's like, you know, butterflies and lizards and whatnot, as opposed to humans. And I have to point out in his retelling of this tale, because Rudolfo Anaya's retelling really is concerned with this incarnation of Quetzalcoatl. He has a great way of characterizing this in a very believable way, not a xenophobic barbarian approach where you'd be like, oh, one guy's saying, let's not kill everybody. Of course, let's do something peaceful. Instead, he's putting it in a form that feels very modern in some respects, where the opposing king is saying, look, I mean, human sacrifice is what we do. We have to have armies. We have to have firm borders. We need to expand and get more farmland. We have to have war. And Topiltzin is standing in opposition to that.
Yeah. So it represents chaos.
Right.
Often peace is represented as chaos.
Yeah. So he's a major threat to the establishment. So the story goes that the king conspires with three sorcerers to deal with Topiltzin.
And this is the militaristic king.
Right, yes.
Okay.
And one of the sorcerers is none other than Quetzalcoatl's archenemy, Tezcatlipoca, in human form.
Whoa.
So they end up using a black mirror to tempt Topiltzin. They corrupt, and in doing so, they corrupt him and make him fully carnal.
So he like loses his god nature?
Yeah. It's like a gradual thing. Like they show him the mirror and he sees himself and becomes a little vain. And then there's an additional level. I think it's a very, very much like a rule of three type thing. And eventually they bring about his downfall and he's, you know, fully carnal.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, he has been defeated. He lays in a stone coffin for 4 days, and then he emerges. He departs on a raft of snakes, and then he immolates himself, and the ashes become rainbow-colored birds that ascend into the sky. And in doing so, Quetzalcoatl passes away from the earth. But he promises to return, to reincarnate at some point in the future in the year Tzeacatl, and this is the Aztec calendar.
Okay.
So the result of this, though, and then again, we have this situation where the myth and the history are entangled. But Topiltzin, the individual, is brought down, and society ends up splintering, and then in doing so, the Toltec dynasty crumbles. But he remains a messianic figure, driven out in disgrace, dying in exile, but prophesies to return.
Well, that is a great story. It makes me want to read this book. This is all from the Rudolfo Anaya book?
Yes. Like I say, the introduction's fabulous, and the book itself is wonderful, too. It's short. It's a short read, so I recommend it.
Yeah, I've got to check that out. But I guess we need to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we can explore more about this story.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you.
I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right, we're back.
All right, so we started off by talking about kind of the crude version of the plumed serpent idea as it appears in, say, slimy bee movies from the early 80s. And then we got into the idea of Quetzalcoatl as actually this magnificent god from Mesoamerican religion. And Robert, you told the story from this excellent sounding book about Quetzalcoatl's coming down to embody this character in the history of the empire, and how all that played out when the hero was betrayed and exiled, and the idea that he might return. So let's pick up from there.
All right. Well, let's jump right in. So one of the issues here is that so far we've been discussing Quetzalcoatl in a pre-Columbian sense. And when we say pre-Columbian Americas, we're of course talking about before the arrival of Columbus, before the arrival of the various Western colonial powers.
Right, the colonial invaders.
Yeah, that would subjugate the both continents. Mm-hmm. And so in this we come to an idea we've discussed on the show before. And that is the idea of an outside context problem. Now, this was a term coined by the late sci-fi author Ian M. Banks to describe a problem faced by a civilization that has no ability to prepare for or scarcely comprehend the problem they're faced with. An OCP, as one may refer to it, is often fatal, and most societies or civilizations only ever encounter one of them. The most common example is one civilization suddenly encountering another civilization of far greater technological power, such as humans encountering an alien species that can travel between the stars.
But a less extreme version of this, of course, could simply be encountering a civilization that has much more advanced weapons of war.
Exactly. For example, beings that are encased in iron and traverse entire oceans in great wooden vessels and capture the power of wind to do so, whose weapons pierce the air like thunder and whose very bodies exude a creeping death that cannot be stopped. And in this, we have the conquistadors. We have the armies of Hernan Cortez, the conquerors of the Spanish Empire that arrive in Mesoamerica.
And of course, we know that the European colonial invaders brought more than one kind of warfare. It wasn't just the explicit technologies. It was like steel armor and swords and guns and stuff. It was also biological warfare.
So in the case of the Spanish arriving in Mesoamerica, this is obviously a situation where there was a lot of destruction, a lot of cultural destruction. This was a catastrophic event for the peoples of the Americas. So we mentioned the year Acatl earlier, the year that Quetzalcoatl was prophesied to return.
Mm-hmm.
So that year ends up rolling around once more, and by Western measure, this was the year 1519, and this was the year as well that Cortez arrived.
Oh no!
So you can understand the confusion, right? You look and you say, well, here, surely this is Quetzalcoatl, returned to claim his throne, attended to by an unnatural army and arriving on what was described as perhaps floating mountains or even the four mythic temples of Quetzalcoatl.
Interesting. Now, I had heard before the idea that when, say, Cortez and his armies arrived, that they were perceived as gods, and I didn't know if that was actually historically true or historically likely, or if maybe that was like an untrue rumor or Spanish tale. Do you have a sense of whether that's actually historically accurate?
Well, it seems to be – again, we don't have complete knowledge of everything that went down, but there do seem to be a few different ways of interpreting this from what I've seen so far.
Uh-huh.
So you're dealing primarily with the ruler Moctezuma II, sometimes referred to as Montezuma.
Okay.
And so he sees this. He sees what's happening. He sees the Spanish that have arrived. And you could say that either, oh, well, he and his people think they're gods, or perhaps just the weirdness of this is enough to make them hesitate.
They didn't know how to respond.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem of an outside context problem, is that you have no context for it, and therefore you don't have a response.
Yeah.
Readily available at hand.
Wisdom is often prudence, holding back and you know, not acting hastily.
Right. So, and you also have other factors at work here. We mentioned the disease factor. You also have the fact that the invaders are fairly quick to align themselves with the enemies of the Aztecs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't take them long to figure out, like, what are the power dynamics and how they can exploit the situation. And however it ends up exactly playing out, it's clear that, you know, the Aztec Empire is toppled within 2 years. Moctezuma II becomes a mere prisoner. But there's another interpretation of events here that I thought was fascinating, and that is that Moctezuma II was apparently, you know, he's worried by the portents of doom, and in the typical mold of rulers, somewhat paranoid about plots against him. And then he meets Cortez and his Spanish retinue, who were, you know, also in awe of this great city. And they're also
That would be Tenochtitlan?
Yes. And again, they've aligned themselves with enemies of the Aztec Empire. And so he ends up presenting Cortez with, quote, the treasure of Quetzalcoatl.
Okay, so Moctezuma presents Cortez with like a religiously significant piece of raiment, a costume.
Right. And as explored briefly in Robert Draper's National Geographic magazine article, Unburying the Aztec, it's possible, too, that Moctezuma II was, quote, cunningly outfitting Cortez in the godly garment of the soon-to-be-sacrificed.
Hmm.
So, again, he doesn't really get into this a lot in this article, but think back again to the rise and fall of Quetzalcoatl.
Okay.
Quetzalcoatl is a king prophesied to return, but also a king whose very story is one of sacrifice and death.
Mm.
So perhaps the idea is that Moctezuma was maybe not so much a fly trapped in the web of symbols and myth, but a spider trying one last clever trick to ensnare his enemy within the trappings of symbol and myth, to turn the people against him by essentially laying a trap of religious belief.
Interesting.
I wasn't able to find much else on this theory, but I find that fascinating. It reminds me of our episode on ritual regicide, the idea that even rulers can be trapped within this mythic cycle of death and rebirth.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that episode much recently, but that was a really interesting one. Yeah, where we talked about all the traditions of the sacrifice of the king. You often think of the king sacrificing, like, you know, other people, captured enemies or whatever.
Yeah.
But sometimes occupying a position of glory also puts a target on you, even a sacred or religious target.
Yeah, so that's an interesting read on this scenario. Obviously, that plan, if that was the plan, did not work.
Yeah.
So what happens after an outside context problem? Well, you end up with a struggle for cultural survival. I mean, that's kind of, in a way, the best case scenario, assuming you're not just completely destroyed, decimated by the encounter. And one of the methods by which the old ways may be preserved is within the new. And we see this tradition of merging the idea of Quetzalcoatl with the apostle St. Thomas from Christian traditions, who is said to have traveled far preaching the gospel.
Hmm.
And you see this, and this is, you know, after the fact. This is certainly more common in, say, the 17th century. But you see this merging of iconography and identity, where you have the plumed serpent god essentially crossed over with this Christian apostle. And by the 17th century, writers and priests began to make more of these comparisons, and the trend ended up dying back down in the 19th century. But it's fascinating to look at how these two figures became, once more, Quetzalcoatl became associated, merged with a historic individual.
You know, I'm tempted to think that I know the members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints believe that Jesus himself came and preached in the Americas, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so you do see this trend within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints of some individuals reinterpreting Quetzalcoatl as Jesus Christ.
Wow.
This, oddly enough, though, I have to point out, has no connection to the so-called Jesus lizard of southern Mexico and Central America, creatures that also bear the name of our previous topic, the basilisk.
Right, the basilisk lizards that can run on top of the water.
Yeah.
Apparently have nothing to do with Quetzalcoatl.
Yeah, they're real lizards as opposed to mythological snake guy.
Now, speaking of reptiles, lizards, snakes, all that kind of stuff, one of the other avenues we wanted to explore the idea of the plumed serpent in is stepping out of the specific religious context of Quetzalcoatl himself, also getting away from the weird Larry Cohen monster version, and looking at biology. So, Robert, do you want to go to a mental place with me?
Okay? Let's do it.
Close your eyes and imagine.
Okay.
Imagine you're wandering through the jungle in Malaysia. In one nearby tree, you notice a snake with a speckled body of black, green, and gold climbing vertically up the trunk of the tree, and it uses its the scales on its underbelly to sort of grip the bark and slowly make its way up the tree. And eventually, it forks off of the main trunk to explore a branch. And you wonder, what's it doing up there? Is it looking for something? Maybe it's looking for a bird's nest to raid or a sleeping bat to eat. And it doesn't find anything on the branch, but it keeps following the branch farther and farther out. And you're like, where's it going? There's not that much branch there, right? And mm-hmm. then it goes all the way to the tip of the branch, and there's just nothing, nowhere left for it to go. Why is it doing that? And you might be wondering this when suddenly the snake coils its head off the branch in kind of a hanging J shape, and then it dives straight off the branch, straight in your direction.
Whoa.
So obviously you might flinch and take cover, right, because a snake just dove straight at you. But then you realize its path is not following a straight line. It's actually not diving straight at you at all, because immediately after the snake leaves the branch, it stops plunging down at a sharp angle and begins gliding smoothly through the air in a kind of horizontal pattern as its body undulates in an S shape. And then finally it lands in another tree branch high above your head in a different tree. You have just watched a snake fly, and these snakes are real.
This would I can see this would be a very alarming thing, because again, if we have an innate fear of snakes and even if not a fear, at least a hyper awareness to them,
right?
Like realizing that snakes can pose a risk to our mortality, and then here's one flying through the air like they should not be able to do. They should be creatures of the ground, and this one is seemingly a creature of the air.
Yeah, I mean it's the thing that should not be. You could not blame someone for reacting with horror and awe. But one thing I should be clear about immediately is that these types of snakes, I believe they are venomous but not especially venomous, so they're not really dangerous to humans. I mean, generally, we don't want to promote snake fear of any kind. But these especially, they're not really dangerous to humans. So there are five species of snake in the genus Chrysopelea, native to South and Southeast Asia, including countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, India, South China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and other places, generally Southern and Southeast Asia. They generally grow up to about 1.2 meters or about 4 feet long, and Chrysopelea are the flying snakes, or perhaps more appropriately, the gliding snakes, because you've got to make that important distinction. I would say usually the way we use the word flying means to travel horizontally through the air on your own power. You know, it's self-powered flight in a way that can theoretically continue gaining altitude, whereas gliding is using existing momentum, the momentum you've already got to travel horizontally through the air without losing altitude too fast. Airplanes fly, hang gliders glide. And these snakes glide. So on average, these snakes can cover a horizontal distance of about 10 meters or about 33 feet from a branch at a starting height of about 9 meters or about 29.5 feet. Some reports have them flying much farther. I read a National Geographic article that claimed they've been known to glide up to 100 meters horizontally, but I couldn't determine the source of that claim. It seems kind of nuts, but you know, maybe. Well, you know, we can take it. So in order to fly like that, obviously the snakes, they can't flap their wings. They don't have wings. So what do they do? How do you generate the lift to glide like that? And the answer is instead of flapping their wings, they turn their whole body into a wing. So wings work, and this would be the simple version, by guiding airflow in such a way as to generate lift. And generally they do this by trying to form a relatively flat horizontal surface under which air can flow and push the flying object up against gravity. So if you're a snake and you want to turn your snake body into a wing or a pseudo wing, one thing you'd probably want to do is make yourself as flat and as wide as possible, and that's exactly what they do. So in recent years, a few studies, often associated with a Virginia Tech biologist named Jake Soka, have captured and analyzed high-speed video of the flying snakes and also made digital and physical models based on these analyses to understand how they glide from tree to tree. And what they found is that these snakes can literally splay their own ribs out to the sides and flatten their body into a semi-concave cross-section. So imagine a snake, you know, you normally imagine the skeleton of a snake. It's got a backbone and then kind of a circle of ribs forming almost a cylinder, right? So imagine that C shape of the ribs instead spreading out like a bird opening its wings. The ribs spread out kind of flat. And in doing this, the snake can basically double its width. But then it also undulates in an S shape as it glides with waves traveling down the length of the body, and this also helps keep it aloft. So the whole process begins with a ballistic dive where the snake reaches off of the branch, spreads its ribs and goes flat, gathers its body into an S shape, and then it begins to wriggle the S shape in large amplitude undulations. And this process allows the snake, instead of falling straight toward the ground, to glide at an angle of about 15 degrees to about 35 degrees until it floats down at its target destination. Speaking to the BBC for an article, Soka characterized it as sort of like the animal is swimming in air.
Oh, wow. I could see where that, just seeing something like that, would open the door for mystical interpretations.
Yeah, you've got to wonder, if somebody saw that in ancient times, how would they not come up with some kind of dragon based on it or something? Yeah. Now, of course, this is not something that you would find in Mesoamerica. So we're not saying that this snake inspired the Quetzalcoatl story or anything like that. But you can see how similar ideas of flying serpents, plumed serpents, might be inspired by something like this. Now, of course, every article about this research also mentions, Robert, can you guess what it also mentions in the very last paragraph of every one of these articles?
Snakes on a plane?
Nope.
Okay.
What will we use this knowledge of analyzing snake flight to do?
Oh, yes. Well, that's the closing of any good science article, right? What are the practical applications?
Build robots. Always robot it says build robots. You know, there's so many of these. I wish we could just get more science articles that say, you know what, it's just great to study snakes. And they don't have to justify it at the end by saying, we will use this knowledge one day to build weapons, snakes that fly into enemy territory in ways you can't possibly imagine.
Well, but at the same time, I do understand that, you know, you want to end on a really strong awe note with a science article. And oftentimes it's the future applications. That's where you find that gold.
But these snakes themselves inspire awe. Look this up. Watch the videos. Imagine this is a snake flying. I mean, it's not gaining out, but it's gliding tree to tree. Yeah. It's amazing to see. This is what's awe inspiring. Not to knock people who make robots. I mean, making robots is great. I didn't mean to come off overly strong there. I'm all for robots, but come on, you don't have to justify it by making robots. You could just study snakes, and that'd be great.
I can get behind that.
One more thing, of course, to mention is that there are, of course, also flying lizards. Again, if you want to go in the sort of flying reptile direction, again, this would be gliding, not flying, but the Draco lizards of the Draco genus are also found in Southeast Asia, and they've got rib flaps that fold up against the body when not in use, but they can be spread out to form a wing and allow the lizard to glide between trees. Now, the thing I was wondering is, why would snakes and lizards need to glide between trees? What's useful about that? And so I think there are a couple of hypotheses. One is that once you're already up in a tree and you want to get in another tree, it might take less energy to glide to another tree than to climb down and climb back up.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But then the other thing, maybe the bigger thing, is that crossing the forest floor exposes you to large predators. The forest floor is the danger zone. Once you're up in a tree, you're safer. So once you are in the safety of a tree, it would be much better if you could glide from tree to tree instead of having to go back down across the forest floor and maybe get picked up by a leopard along the way.
Now, this might not be a factor, but it also seems like if something were perhaps following you or stalking you, you know, this is a great way to escape them from one tree to the other.
You can glide and it can't.
Yeah.
If there's a monkey in the tree that wants to eat you, you know, you can glide farther than that monkey can jump.
Potentially, yeah. Though some of those monkeys can jump.
Right. All right, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will discuss the king of the beastly flyers of the ancient past, the pterosaurs.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, Well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right, we're back. Robert, take me to the pterosaurs.
All right. Well, we're talking about one particular pterosaur. We're all familiar with pterosaurs, I think, at this point. These are the flying creatures of the prehistoric world, the flying lizards of the prehistoric world.
Not dinosaurs.
Right, not dinosaurs. You call them a dinosaur, your six-year-old will correct you. I have had this happen before. I guess sometimes you do just sort of non-scientifically, you just refer to everything from the dinosaur age as a dinosaur. And it's inaccurate to call everything a dinosaur. So the king, or one of the kings of the pterosaurs, was undisputably a creature that is that now bears the name Quetzalcoatlus. And you'll never guess what he's named after. He's named after Quetzalcoatl, the Mesoamerican snake god.
Robert, you actually did a reading from a children's book on the podcast one time that had a great little sub story about Quetzalcoatlus, and it ended with this. I am Quetzalcoatlus.
Yes, I forget the author's name offhand, but if you do a search for "I am Quetzalcoatlus" or "I am," I think there's one on Diplodocus as well. But they're all like really – they're all really good children's books about dinosaurs that do not candy coat the life and death nature of a prehistoric creature's life.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about as far as Quetzalcoatlus goes, we're talking about the Cretaceous period, and we're talking about the region that is now known as North America. First fossils were discovered in Texas in the early 1970s, and this creature was apparently just a flying monster. This thing was incredibly huge. The estimated wingspan, and this is something that's changed over the years, that was higher than they've kind of scaled back. Current data seems to put it estimated at around 33 to 36 feet, or 10 to 11 meters.
Wow.
That's roughly the wingspan of a mid-sized airplane. For instance, the World War II U.S. fighter P-51 Mustang, that had a wingspan of 37 feet or 11.28 meters. The swept wingspan of an F-14 Tomcat, that's the fighter plane from Top Gun for anybody who can make that connection, that has a swept wingspan of 38 feet or 11.55 meters.
What does swept mean?
So the F-14 can fly with its wings in a swept position or in an extended position.
Oh, I see. When it becomes sort of streamlined.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There was a great G.I. Joe toy airplane that was essentially an F-14, and it had wings that moved like that. That's my main connection with it.
So compared to other things that fly and have wings, this thing was an absolute beast.
Absolutely. I mean, even if it's on the ground, this was a huge creature. So in a bipedal stance, it would have stood roughly 3 meters or 9.8 feet tall. And it may have scrambled around in like this kind of quadrupedal stance, however, much like a bat. Have you ever seen it?
A bat's crawl
or some of the – I think there's
it's
one –
It's creepy looking.
It's creepy, yeah. There's one particular – I believe there's even one particular species of bat that's primarily ground-based. And it is – yeah, it's kind of creepy to look at. So this thing might have scrambled around like that. But by many estimates, including Ruda and Benton in Evolution of Morphological Disparity in Pterosaurs from 2011 – this mighty flying beast would have probably stood roughly as tall as a modern-day giraffe but with just a far larger head.
Yeah, kind of like giraffe with like a screwed up lizard like pelican head.
Yeah, like this great squatting winged beast. Just imagine that thing looming over you.
I feel like this thing should be right up there with the Tyrannosaurus Rex. You know, people should appreciate it on the same level.
Yeah, I mean, I
mean, really, it's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's certainly all the pterosaurs are amazing creatures to look back on. This evolved mode of flying that again is a little bit different from birds or bats. It is like we have essentially three modes of vertebrate flight that evolved, and this is one of them.
And that's talking about powered flight, not gliding.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. You know, and thinking about this, you know, again, it would have seemed like a god if you were able to see it. And I can't help but think of Edgar Rice Burroughs' Pellucidar, I believe is the pronunciation, series of books. That's a setting that he did.
I haven't read them.
I haven't either, but I was introduced to them just by some of the art initially. They feature a psychic master race of flying reptiles called the Mahars. And they pop up they also pop up in the 1976 movie At the Earth's Core, starring Peter Cushing,
yes,
Doug McClure,
oh boy,
and Caroline Monroe.
Wow, I've got to see that. How have I not?
Well, I'll tell you, it's actually one of the movies in the most recent Mystery Science Theater 3000 season. So
with that all-star cast?
That all-star cast. If you want to see Peter Cushing just totally misused in a film, this is a great place to find it.
Peter Cushing was misused in about 90% of the films he was in.
Yeah. But this one especially, because you got Doug McClure in there to play kind of a goofus, which he did well. I love Doug McClure.
Yeah, he's the classic mid-century movie lug.
Yeah. But then Peter Cushing also kind of plays a doofus. So it's like he's a scientist doofus, and then you have like two different levels of doofus going up against forces they can't comprehend.
How sharp are his cheekbones in it? Does he cut anything with them?
I don't know. They might have been dulling a bit by that point, I have to say. But he's still – it's still Peter Cushing, so it's still a lot of fun. But you have these kind of wretched-looking pterosaur, Mahar creatures that show up in the film. There's also a – I think it's a Boris Vallejo painting that was done for one of these book covers that has, a scantily clad woman, and there's this pterosaur creature, one of these Mahars, creeping up on her to snatch her away. Because, you know, it's Edgar Rice Burroughs. That's kind of the plot.
Yeah.
And I can't help but assume that the Mahars also inspired the Savage Land mutant Sauron from the X-Men comics. Not Sauron from Lord of the Rings, but the what is essentially like a pterosaur humanoid that the mutants battle in those comic books.
Okay, so what else do we know about this creature, the Quetzalcoatlus?
All right. Well, in a way, it's fitting that the creature is named for a god with so much mystery around it, because a lot of mystery remains surrounding this massive winged prehistoric creature. And this, of course, is par for the course with fossil remains. Paleontologists have to solve the riddle of the remains as best they can. Mm-hmm. We have all these, you know, massive gaps in the fossil record, and that's just part of trying to understand the past through fossils. We have, based on current data, only one adult Quetzalcoatlus fossil to go off of, and it's only wing fragments. Hmm. The other specimens have been like smaller, like younger specimens.
Yeah.
So we've seen a wide range of estimates then regarding the flying or gliding abilities of the Quetzalcoatlus. A creature with more of an inland range than many of its flying relatives.
So we don't know we don't know for sure to what extent it flew.
Exactly. For instance, Donald M. Henderson went so far in his 2009 Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology article to wonder if it could fly at all. He argued that given its estimated body mass, this was maybe a flightless creature.
Oh, yeah. It might be like the ostrich of pterosaurs or something.
Right.
Yeah, you always have to wonder because, I mean, so there are limits on the size that an organism could reasonably be expected to fly, right? You know, you might wonder, like, how come dragons don't exist? Why don't we see birds with 100-foot wingspan? Mm-hmm. And I think part of that has to do with, like, how mass scales up with relationship to volume, right? Like, one of the reasons you can't get super giant creatures is there would be cooling problems with, like, the surface area of the giant creature. How much stuff it's got inside it.
Right.
And you would probably encounter similar problems when you keep trying to scale up bigger and bigger flying organisms. As the mass keeps going up, it's going to take more and more power to lift that mass off the ground. And, you know, you can generate lift in multiple ways. You can have bigger wings, but eventually, like, you'd run into structural problems, like where bones would not be strong enough to support the wings at a certain amount of, you know, size and weight. Or you could have more powerful muscles to flap them harder and faster, but eventually you might run into fuel problems. I mean, there are just physics limits on how big a flying organism can get.
And, you know, I have to say that a flightless Quetzalcoatlus is terrifying in its own way, because here it would be a situation where here's a creature that is like, I don't have to fly anymore because I'm enormous and I will just eat you with my toothless beak. I will just gobble you up.
I mean, this is not based on evidence. This is just speculating. I wonder if you could also imagine something like a chicken, where it's not a flying bird, but it's a bird that can sort of like use wings to get off the ground for a short period of time. I mean, you wonder about, like, maybe it doesn't sustain flight, but it sort of like hops up and flies very briefly in order to swoop down and pounce something.
Right. But this is not the only argument. You have the other end of the spectrum, for instance, where a British paleontologist Mark Witten, working with biomechanics researcher Mike Habib, modeled the creature in 2010 and argued that it could fly up to 80 miles an hour, 128 kilometers per hour, for 7 to 10 days at altitudes of 15,000 feet or 4.6 kilometers, with a maximum range of between 8,000 and 12,000 miles. That's up to 19,312 kilometers.
Wow.
So that's some range.
Yeah, so if you're a Flintstone and you want to ride a dinosaur for like a transoceanic flight, this is the one you want to snag.
Yeah,
no, it's not a dinosaur. Sorry, a pterosaur.
Quetzalcoatlus Air. Yeah. But then we also have more balanced approaches falling in between these two. For instance, paleobiologist David Unwin believes that the creatures could certainly fly, but we don't really have a lot else to go on. Again, think to the limited fossils we talked about earlier. He argues that the distance estimates here might be just premature. It's also been argued in some of these models that the creature, if it could fly, you know, it could probably get aloft via a high-powered four-legged pounce into the air, which I have to say that alone is just amazing to try and envision. Imagine this massive dump truck of a creature just launching into the air and then flapping like crazy and ascending.
A winged giraffe with a giant pelican head leaping into the clouds.
And then once it's up or once it lands again, the question is, well, what does it eat? Well, one theory
you.
Was
– the answer is you.
Well, yes. If we were around, that would probably be a possibility. But one theory was that it was a scavenger and it used its long beak to like dig into dino corpses, which would also seem to work given their inland range. You know, so this is not a thing that's going out and eating a lot of sea creatures, but perhaps it's flying over vast distances and encountering dead dinosaurs and it can go down and feast.
Mm-hmm. And of course, flying is an attractive foraging strategy for scavengers.
Right. Yeah. You have a tremendous ability to take in the surrounding region. But they also could have skimmed fish from freshwater lakes and rivers. That's one theory. But it's also been pointed out that they likely lacked the neck structure and jaw to really carry that out. A more likely hypothesis, apparently, is that they fed much like a modern stork, stalking shorelines for large and small prey alike.
Hmm.
And I have to say that that is a terrifying possibility, because if you've ever seen footage of storks engaging in this sort of terrestrial hunting practice, It can be pretty horrifying. I accidentally showed some footage from a documentary. I want to say it was Disney's Flamingo documentary to my son, and he was younger at the time. And there's this scene where the stork just is stalking the shore and gobbling up live flamingo chicks.
Ugh.
And it's absolutely horrifying. After he saw that, there was some later point we'd forgotten about it. And then we tried to show him a cartoon that has, you know, the typical like stork and baby motif.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been one of the Pixar shorts. And he was instantly not having any of it. He's like, I know what storks are about. And you're not going to show me this short film that involves human babies and storks, because I know what's going to happen. That baby is going to get gobbled.
No, I mean, we try to present a level-headed view of predation in nature, but Sometimes I just do have a visceral emotional reaction, and I know exactly what you're talking about. I haven't seen Storks, but I've seen video of, I believe it was in some David Attenborough narrated documentary, mm-hmm. That had not storks, but pelicans eating baby birds. Just horrifying. Watch it. Like the way they don't blink, they just got these big mm-hmm. lower beak areas and they just scoop up the baby birds in, and they're like wings and legs poking out of their mouth and stuff. It's just horrible.
Oh, frightful. So
no, I'm sorry. No, I shouldn't apply that moralistic tone to nature, but like it is hard to watch.
But here's the question. With a Quetzalcoatlus, would it be able to scoop sunbathers up from a New York rooftop? I would say probably not. I think it would need to land in Central Park, where it would still have plenty to eat. It could attack picnickers and like young people making out on blankets, uh-huh. School groups that have arrived there to play soccer or whatnot. There's so much to eat in Central Park.
Hey, we've seen Pizza Rat. Now you get Pizza Quetzalcoatlus.
Exactly. Just the junk food. It doesn't need to even deal with live prey. All right. Well, as we begin to close things out here, I do want to mention that there Quetzalcoatl has survived to a certain extent, or reemerged in culture. It hasn't been like the complete second coming that was perhaps prophesized, but he remains a figure of interest. And sometimes you actually see physical, like new physical manifestations of him. There's a really cool Quetzalcoatl statue in San Jose, California, for instance. I have not seen it in person yet, but I was reading about it on Atlas Obscura, and it points out that it's downtown, it's very Aztec in style, and it was controversial back in the 90s as it cost about $500,000, and also some Christian fundamentalists claimed that this was going to be a place of where people were going to worship a bloodthirsty god.
Oh, yeah. They were saying that there were going to be human sacrifices at the statue.
Which, of course, based on everything we've discussed regarding this god, that was not going to be the case. Or if it was, it would have been very misinformed cultist showing up there.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, other critics just argue that it was a religious sculpture on public grounds and then shouldn't be allowed. But then there's the criticism that they say that the sculpture kind of looks like coiled dog poop.
Well, I guess coiled serpents sometimes do.
Yeah. Well, it's pointed out on Atlas Obscura, and there is no author attributed on this particular article. The positioning here isn't crazy, especially when you look at some of the architectural motifs of, say, the Aztecs of Quetzalcoatl. And it also matches up with this description of the god that D.H. Lawrence made in his 1926 novel, The Plumed Serpent, where he describes, quote, "snakes coiled like excrement, snakes fanged and feathered beyond all dreams of dread."
Hmm. I have not ventured into that D.H. Lawrence book.
Lawrence's novel, by the way, concerns the Mexican Revolution and a cult attempting to revive the old religion of Mexico. And he apparently wanted to title the book Quetzalcoatl, but his publishers disagreed.
I can see why. Nobody's going to be able to pronounce that.
Well, it's probably one of the reasons probably Larry Cohen's film was called Q the Winged Serpent, right?
Exactly, yeah.
One other point of possible interest, I haven't
now,
read—
Now, wait a minute. Do you think that Larry Cohen's movie was in any way based on the D.H. Lawrence novel?
I have not read anything to suggest that it was. I would say that no, it's probably not. But in a maybe so, in a very Larry Cohen kind of way. Like he picked up on, like, cultist, bringing back an old religion, let's get a giant monster in there and you got a movie.
Yeah.
On another literary note, I'm very interested to check out, I haven't read these yet, but the author Aliette de Bedard wrote the Obsidian and Blood trilogy, a trilogy of books that I've seen described as a like pre-Columbian Aztec noir.
Ooh, that sounds cool.
Yeah. So I'm interested to check that out. And again, I want to say that Anaya's book that I referenced at the top of the podcast is an excellent read and readily available in Kindle and physical format, however you like to read your books.
Awesome. I think I'll be checking that one out.
All right. So there you have it. We've gone from B-movie monsters to Mesoamerican gods to prehistoric creatures, flying snakes. What more could you ask for?
Well, you could ask for more Monster Science content, which we will be bringing to you for the rest of the month.
That's right. You can check out all these episodes at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes. That's where you'll find links out to our various social media accounts. That's where you will find a tab at the top of the page that has our store on it. Click go to the store. Buy some merchandise with our logo. It's a great way to support the show. But if you don't want to spend money and you want to support the show, then rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. It really helps us out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, let us know where you listen from, how you found out about the show, and so forth, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.